Said it's a harsh life, and there's no room for soft parenting. Still, my hands clutch the baby a little tighter. A rap sounds at the door.
Come in, Eric,
Edwin calls in English. When Dalton enters, he says,
Done playing with Jamie?
Dalton grunts. Edwin continues.
I'll see that you get your hat and scarf back before you go, and I'll speak to his father.
Dalton nods, and at that, the matter is dropped.
So, Casey tells me you found this baby,
Edwin says,
and you're looking for her people. As much as it pains me to say this, if she was found in the snow,
he glances toward the door.
It's the beginning of winter. All signs point toward a long and cold one. A practice of contraception, if I may be indelicate, is limited to less than foolproof methods. We advocate keen attention to monthly cycles, and children must be born before late summer. We would certainly never abandon a winter baby, but in the forest, between the hostels and the nomads,
he shrugs.
There is, I fear, a reason why the child was left alone in the snow.
Under other circumstances, I'd agree, I say. However, she wasn't alone. We found her with a dead woman who was not her mother. His eyes glitter.
That is intriguing. Yeah,
Dalton says.
I know your English seems perfect, but I would think the word you want is tragic.
Edwin only shoots him a withering look. He turns to me and says,
Explain.
In Mandarin, a clear slight to Dalton. When I answer, it's in English. The woman had been murdered, I say. She died holding the infant, but our doctor says she's not the mother. The baby was wrapped only in skin, so I have no clues to her identity. I do have some to the woman's, though, which I hope will lead me in the direction I need to go. I hand the baby to Dalton, then open my pack and pull out a decorated portion of the woman's parka that I cut off for easy transport. I pass him the piece. I have the ankle bracelet, too, but I want to show him this first. When I do, he gives a slow nod as he runs the fabric through his fingers. You recognize the handiwork? I say. He hands it back.
If I say I do not, will you accept that the baby is abandoned?
We aren't looking for an excuse to keep a baby, Edwin.
Perhaps, but I am looking for an excuse to stop you from returning this child to her family.
Why?
Because you would make a good mother. You are young, strong, intelligent. Eric would make a good father. He is young and strong.
Dalton snorts, not missing the adjective Edwin has skipped. Edwin only smiles and looks at me, with a wave at Dalton.
See how happy that baby is with Eric? How easily he holds it? How he helped young Jamie? He is a natural father. That's rare. You should take advantage of it.
By stealing a baby so Eric will be stuck with me? I say. Not exactly my recipe for a happy family.
Oh, I'm sure he would be very happy to be stuck with you. Wouldn't you, Eric?
Dalton only rolls his eyes, and I say, I'm not taking this baby from her family. If you know who they are,
I do, which is why I am suggesting you forget them. The child was abandoned, found with a dead woman who probably is her mother. Your doctor was clearly wrong. The child is motherless and alone. You should take her.
So which is it? The baby was abandoned or orphaned? He shrugs.
Both. The mother is dead. The father and any other family are obviously not combing the forest looking for her. The child is better off with you.
Dalton tenses. Edwin looks at him, and it's a keen look, a piercing one. I know what's coming next. I feel the subject shifting, and I open my mouth to stop it, but Edwin says,
You don't think you were better off in Rockton, Eric? No,
Dalton says tightly.
I don't. But Jean Dalton thought you were. Snatched you up and kept you, and you made no attempt to leave. You must have thought it was better. An easy life for a boy. So much easier than in the forest.
Dalton's holding himself so rigid he barely gets the words out.
I did try to escape. Eventually, you gave up, though. resigned yourself to the easier life. Such a hardship.
My parents didn't come for me, he says. They obviously thought I was better where I was.
Edwin's laugh is sharp.
So that's what made you stop. A child's pride. The boy sulking in the corner and telling himself his mother and father had abandoned him? Do you really think they didn't risk their lives trying to get you back? So you agree then,
Dalton says, his voice low,
that taking me was wrong. And yet here you are telling us to take this child?
We stand on a precipice, one where I see the answers to Dalton's past below. I can get them from Edwin. Dalton can get them too. Yet to take that step means accepting the plummet that must go with it. His relationship with the Daltons is already precarious. If he learns that they didn't just naively rescue him from the forest, but deliberately kept his birth parents away, he'd need to sever all ties with them. In redirecting the conversation, Dalton has stepped back from that precipice. He doesn't want answers beyond what Edwin has already given. He isn't ready for them. I can't tell whether this retreat from truth diminishes Dalton in Edwin's regard. It doesn't matter. Dalton will do what he needs to protect himself until he's ready for more, and no one can judge a person for those choices. They are what keeps us sane, what keeps us moving forward.
This is not the same thing, Edwin says. Your parents were young and naive, but they were good parents, and their sons came first. You were not mistreated nor neglected in any way. In fact, I personally worried whether they were properly preparing you boys for this life. It is one thing to teach hunting and foraging and trading skills, but we need more out here. We need a harshness and a ruthlessness that your parents lacked, and therefore could not pass on to you. If your father saw Jamie tossed out of his warm cabin, he'd have gone after the boy's father. You check that impulse. You make sure he is warm and you help, but you do not let him shirk his duties. You would never say his parents don't deserve to keep him. This baby is different. Her people, his lips curl. Her people make Jamie's dad look like Father of the Year.
My breath catches, but I push it back and force myself to say, their worthiness as parents isn't for us to decide.
Is it not? Down south, they have child services. When I was a lawyer, my firm took on many cases of parents fighting to have their children returned. I refused to work on them. While there were cases of injustice, the children I saw were better off. I'm sure you saw the same in policing.
He isn't looking for a thoughtful, long-winded response, and that's the only one I could give. Yes, I saw children taken from bad situations who blossomed and thrived in foster care. Those are the success stories, and there were plenty of them. But there were others, too. Parents who screwed up and lost their kids and didn't get a second chance. Kids volleyed from institution to foster care and back, who fled to find their birth parents, because however tough that life had been, it was better than the alternative. Tell us where we can find the parents, I say. We'll take it from there. His lips tighten.
She would be better off.
We will take it from there, I say, enunciating each word, my gaze locked with his. Either you trust us to do that, or you don't.
You'll have to wait until spring anyway, he says. They're nomadic, traders. It's an extended family. The parents aren't from Rockton. I've heard they were criminals who fled to the Yukon ahead of the law. I certainly believe it. While I would prefer not to trade with them, they bring items we cannot get otherwise. They travel all the way to Dawson for them. I don't know where they overwinter, but they'll be back in spring.
The baby starts to fuss in Dalton's arms. I reach for the pack and fill a makeshift bottle with warm milk from a thermos. Dalton takes it, and the baby quiets.
You are a natural mother, Casey,
Edwin says.
Like Eric is a natural father. You didn't even stop to think what she might want.
So this family of traders, I say, they make goods like this? I lifted the fabric.
They do.
And it was on the dead woman, not the baby, which doesn't mean the child comes from them.
One of their women was pregnant when they were here last. I say woman, but she was barely more than a girl. As for the baby's father, let's just say goods aren't the only thing that family sells.
He motions to the fabric.
This woman who died, my guess is that she stole the baby. She must trade with him regularly, and she knew what kind of life that child would have, particularly a girl. So she stole her.
He meets my gaze.
To honor her sacrifice, you should keep the baby.
I snort a laugh.
Yeah, no.
He shrugs.
It was worth a try.
The old man rises.
Now let's get your hat and scarf back, Eric. I'll also have you speak to Jamie's mother, Casey. He's our youngest resident, and she may have advice for the baby.
Chapter 12. Jamie's mother seems like a kind woman, if not the sort who's likely to challenge her spouse. Edwin sends the father on an errand, and we settle into the small cabin, Dalton playing with the boy while I talk to his mother. She cuddles the baby and coos over her, and we discuss the challenges of caring for an infant in the forest. Or it's a challenge for me. For her, it's called life. She's third generation herself, 22 years old, her son already 5. Which makes me wonder just how old this baby's mother is, if Edwin called her little more than a girl. Afterward, Dalton and I leave. We don't talk for a while. We want to be farther from the settlement before we do. I'm about to speak when Dalton raises a finger and wraps one arm around the baby bundle under his jacket as he lifts his gun and scans what seems to be a silent forest. Then I catch the squeak of a boot on snow. I pull out my weapon. Dalton calls.
You have 5 seconds to show yourselves.
He doesn't finish the threat. He could say, or I start firing, but then he'd need to, and that's a waste of ammo.
5, 4, 3,
he wheels, gun aimed, and I hear a sharp intake of breath, though I see nothing in the lengthening shadows.
You settlers love playing this game, don't you?
He says.
Let's test Eric Dalton. See how good a tracker he really is.
He wags the gun toward where it's pointing.
There's one of you.
He moves it to the left.
2.
Then back around behind him.
3. Please tell me there's a prize, because there's never a prize, and I'm starting to feel discouraged. The prize is you saw us before we put an arrow in you,
a voice says. Dalton grunts.
Yes, so. Still, I'd like an actual prize. Okay, kids, step out where I can see you, and let's have a civil conversation. Kid?
There's clear affront in his voice, but the young man who steps out isn't any older than Sebastian. Dalton shrugs.
Compared to me, you are, though you're older than your 2 companions.
The young man glances around, seeing no sign of his companions.
How can you tell that? Because they let you speak while they cower behind the trees like children.
That brings the other 2 out. I can't say for certain whether they are indeed younger. All 3 are in their late teens. The one already out is dark-haired and sporting a sparse beard. The 2nd is another boy, tow-headed and smooth-cheeked. The 3rd is a girl with straight dark hair and skin the same shade as my own. When she says, "What business do you have with my grandfather?" I'm not surprised. "That would be between Edwin and us," I say. She shrugs off my non-reply as if she hadn't expected an answer. "We'd like to trade. We have furs, caribou, fox, ermine, and mink." She passes me her mitten. It's soft suede lined with ermine. "I can make more. Jackets, too." She looks at mine. "They're prettier than that." I reach into my pocket and tug out the embroidered piece of leather. "Like this?" Her nose wrinkles. "Better. That crafter has spent too much time on the decoration, too little on the tanning."
"You know the work?"
She shrugs. "I've seen it. You don't want that. You want mine." "What if I wanted both? Something from you and something from this person? Your grandfather said it's from a family of traders and he doesn't know where they overwinter." "He knows," she says, "and he does you a favor not sending you to them. Your man," she nods to Dalton, "is too rich, and you are too pretty. They'd offer to trade and then kill him for his goods and take you." She has her grandfather's directness, but with her, it's blunt. No coy calculation. Even when she tells me I'm pretty, it's a simple assessment, devoid of flattery. At her words, my heart sinks. I'd hoped she'd tell me a story different from her grandfather's. What are you looking to trade for? I ask. She points at my gun, and Dalton mutters,
"Of course."
I could drop the conversation here. Maybe I should. But an idea sparks, something I hadn't asked Edwin, knowing I wouldn't get a straight answer. It's too loaded a question to ask outright. This could be a sideways step into it, though. "Do you know what this is?" I say, lifting my weapon. Her face hardens. "I'm not an ignorant savage. It's a gun." I meant the type of gun. "You have a rifle or two in the settlement, right?" "We do." "This isn't a rifle. It's a handgun, intended for self-defense. It'll do a lousy job of taking down a buck, unless it's charging at you and you just want to empty the entire magazine into it. This is a semi-automatic weapon, a 9mm. That means two things. It fires a lot of ammo, and it fires a very specific type. I know that's your biggest challenge up here, getting ammunition. No trader is going to carry this." I open the weapon and show her the cartridges. Then I nod toward Dalton's weapon. "That's a revolver, also for self-defense. An entirely different type of ammo, though." He opens it and shows her. I continue. "We have a third handgun in town for our deputy. It's a 45. Again, another kind of ammo. Now, first, we can't give you any of those three because they're the only handguns we have, and we keep them on us at all times." I add the last to be clear they won't find them lying around Rockton. "We can get ammo for them. You can't. Once the magazine is empty, you'd have a lovely paperweight." Her brow furrows, and I realize paperweight wouldn't mean anything to her. "A dead weight," I amend. "Now, if you wanted to trade for a rifle, we might be able to arrange something. We don't carry ours unless we're hunting. Otherwise, they're secured in a gun safe, and even I can't get at them." "We'd be willing to consider trading you a rifle, but we'd need to know what caliber you have already and whether we can match it. Otherwise," I shrug. "You're back to the same problem of ammo." The girl nods. "My grandfather is very careful about that. Our rifles are all 308s. Dalton grunts behind me. He's finally figured out where this odd line of conversation was going. I seeded in the information about our gun lockers as a matter of security. But the main purpose is to find out what type of weapons the first settlement has and whether they match the one used to kill the murdered woman. While her death isn't my top priority, I'm a homicide detective. I'm not going to ignore a chance to solve it. There'd been no way to ask Edwin this without his guessing why I was asking and tailor his response accordingly. While his granddaughter is obviously bright and shrewd, she's also young, and she doesn't sense a trap here. She's focused on her goal of getting a gun. "I can't promise you a trade," I say, "but we might have an old—" "We want that gun," the bearded youth says, pointing at Dalton's. These two boys have been silent until now. Dalton had called this one the leader because he stepped out first, but it's obvious that the girl is in charge. She just wasn't foolish enough to expose herself so quickly. Having stepped out, she's done all the talking, and the boys let her, as if they're accustomed to this.
"We want a handgun, as you call it," he says. "I like his. It has bigger bullets."
The girl rolls her eyes.
"Bigger only means it'll put bigger holes in our dinner. The barrels are too short, meant for shooting at close range. That's not what I want."
"I want—"
"And what are you going to trade for it?" she says. "This gun is for me."
"You do not need a gun. I will hunt for you when you are my wife."
"Which is why I am never going to be your wife, Angus," she says. And Dalton snorts at that, earning a sour look from the bearded boy. Angus.
"If Felicity wants to hunt, she should," says the tow-headed boy, who looks a year or so younger than the others. "She is good at it."
"Do you mean that?" Felicity retorts. "Or is it false flattery to win my approval?"
The tow-headed boy stammers, searching for a response. Then he says,
"You are a good hunter. And if you married me, I would let you help me hunt."
"How kind of you," Felicity says dryly. She turns to me. "The gun is for me. My grandfather says I may only have one if I barter for it myself.
I can't promise anything, but let me see what we have, and the next time we come by, I'll speak to you.
While I'm not eager to supply the first settlement with weapons, hers is a reasonable request. We shouldn't refuse them the means of survival for fear they'll turn those hunting tools on us. I also suspect Edwin's granddaughter would be a good ally to have among the younger generation. The trio starts to leave. Then Felicity says something to them, and they stay where they are while she jogs back to us. When she decides we're out of earshot of the boys, she stops.
I wanted to say thank you, she says, for taking Harper away.
We didn't take her, I say. She left. Felicity nods dismissively, as if this is the same thing.
She is Angus's little sister, so he will not appreciate me saying this, but even he would agree. She was not right. Dangerous. We knew it. Angus saw it. She would do things that hurt him, and she would not care, as long as she got what she wanted. The elders never saw it. She was very, very careful.
She was, I'm about to say, a good actor, but Felicity won't understand that. She was very good at being what others wanted to see.
Yes. Sometimes, living like this, it does things to people, makes them hard and cruel. I just wanted to say thank you.
Her eyes cloud for a second as she glances at the boys.
She is gone, yes? Not coming back?
Almost certainly not. Her lips set, as if that's not as clear an answer as she'd like. But she nods and says,
I hope not, for all our sakes.
Then, without another word, she lopes back to the waiting boys. Chapter 13. When the young settlers are gone, I say to Dalton,
Were you okay with that?
I didn't promise her a rifle.
If I wasn't okay with it, I'd have said so. It's worth considering. Those boys might be vying for her hand, but they don't interrupt when she talks. That means Edwin is grooming her for leadership. She seems smart, level-headed. Wanting to trade for her own hunting rifle is reasonable. I'd make it a hard bargain, but I wouldn't discount it.
He slows to adjust the baby, stirring from sleep. She fusses, but a few pats and rubs on her back quiet her. Dalton resumes talking.
So the gun that killed the woman didn't come from the first settlement. That helps.
It does. As for the baby's family, if they're as bad as Edwin and Felicity say, I inhale.
I don't know what to do about that.
He takes a few more steps and then says, his voice lower.
Yeah, you do. We both do. We wouldn't find a beaten dog in the forest and return it to abusive owners. It's a tough call, but we have to make the choice we can live with. The problem is judging.
How bad is too bad? I say.
Yeah.
He goes quiet after that. And I think he's going to stay that way until we reach the snowmobile. Then he straightens and says,
Main thing now is finding them. I know Edwin says they don't overwinter around here, but the baby hasn't been away from her mother for long. They must be within a day's walk.
I'm about to say that we'll have time to do that today before being stopped by the immovable obstacle of winter. Night. We can't make it before darkness falls. Dalton has already figured this out and continues with,
We'll head back to Rockton for the night, and then tomorrow we'll go find Jacob.
He trails off, cursing as he remembers his brother isn't around.
Tyrone?
I say. He grumbles, but says,
Yeah, we'll find Ty. See what he knows about these traitors.
The next morning, we take the baby to Jen's place for the day. We expect to be coming back after talking to Cypher, so there's no reason to cart her along. Instead, we take Storm. We'd considered riding the horses, but snow fell overnight, and it's still falling the next morning. So we strap on snowshoes and head out. Of all the mobility tools in Rockton, snowshoes are my least favorite. Dalton jokes that's because, as opposed to the horses, ATVs, and snowmobiles, snowshoes require actual physical effort. It's not just effort, though. It's serious effort. More than walking, which seems to defy the purpose of a mobility tool. Except that Well, if we're using snowshoes, it's because walking in boots wouldn't be faster or easier.
Our weekend trip had been along groomed paths. This walk will have a lot more backwoods hiking, and each step is like clomping down into knee-high mud. Snowshoes keep you on the surface, even if they're hellishly awkward to use. Or they are for me. Dalton's fine with them. He says I just need more practice. Since that means more trudging around in snowshoes, I'll stick to amateur status. If I will grudgingly admit to one advantage to snowshoes, it's that they're excellent for hunting. They move nearly as silently as cross-country skis. And yes, I've suggested those to Dalton. He's hesitating because that's a mode of transport he's not accustomed to. And God forbid, he should struggle. Admittedly, he's not sure how well they'll work in this environment. Maybe I'll ask for a cheap pair for Christmas to test them. I might have been hired as a homicide detective, but my self-assigned secondary role is transportation chief. The chick who will ultimately bring to Rockton every possible, and possibly fun, way to traverse the wilderness. Dirt bike, dog sled, and soon, cross-country skis. Dalton doesn't appreciate my efforts nearly as much as he should. Perhaps not surprising, given that he spent his career trying to convince residents that traveling outside of the town is not fun. Not fun at all. Since we have the snowshoes and we're heading into the game-rich area, we both carry rifles slung over our shoulders. We've also brought a makeshift harness and canvas sled bag for Storm to bring back any larger game. For now, Storm is free to romp through the snow. We've shot 4 ptarmigan, but Dalton has those slung over his shoulder. Down south, I'd known plenty of cops who hunted, and some would invite me. I never accepted. I wasn't rabidly against hunting. As a non-vegetarian, I'd be hypocritical to judge anyone for killing their own meat. I just wasn't always convinced that my colleagues hunted for meat. Sure, they'd get some of their kill carved up, but most of that stayed at the bottom of their freezer, an excuse for the sport. Up here, it's all about utility. Meat, fur, even the feathers to stuff pillows and jackets. Nothing is sport. Nothing is waste. That's the type of hunting I can endorse. Though neither of us will pretend there isn't pleasure to be had in the thrill of a well-aimed shot. We have a good 3-hour hike ahead of us. Tyrone Cipher is wintering at a cabin he inherited when the former owner was killed by our resident cougar. Cipher had been sheriff of Rockton before Gene Dalton arrived. The council decided Gene's temperament was more suited to the position, and they demoted Cipher to deputy. He'd stuck around for a while, but after one too many clashes with Gene, he'd stomped off into the forest, where he's still sulking. Okay, sulking might be a slight exaggeration. Cipher had already intended to retire into the forest when his term in Rockton was up. His temper and his pride just sent him there sooner than he planned. Cipher is happy in the forest. His former job made him a natural for tracking and hunting game. That former job isn't as sheriff of Rockton. It's the career that brought him here. Tyrone Cipher was a hitman. The first time he told me that, I thought he was joking. Then I thought he was exaggerating. Maybe he once killed a guy for money? Nope. He was a career hitman. I'd say assassin, but that conjures up an image that is 100% not Tyrone Cipher. Cipher had been in Rockton when Dalton first arrived. He knows Dalton's history, which makes for an awkward relationship, especially when Cipher sees nothing wrong with needling Dalton about his wild boy past. We're a couple of kilometers from the cabin when Dalton goes still. As he looks around, I lay a hand on Storm's head. When a growl ripples through her flanks, I slide my hand through her collar. She grumbles at that, offended that I don't trust her. As Dalton scans the forest, Storm resumes that low growl. She's on high alert, her hackles up, body stiff, which means there's a predator nearby. I slide my gun out. Dalton already has his in hand. His head tilts as if he's spotted something. He slides forward for a better view. Then he nods, backs up, and takes Storm's collar.
"Go look,"
he whispers, a hint of a smile on his lips.
"Slow and careful. I'll direct you."
I nod at my gun.
"Keep it out,"
he mutters. It is a predator, then. A dangerous one.
just not the type he expects to barrel out of the forest and attack.
Interesting.
I slide forward where he'd gone. It's clear, no chance of hitting branches and giving myself away. When I reach where he stopped, he motions for me to take it one more step. Then he has me crouch until my eyes are at waist level and he directs my attention. At first, I see nothing but snow and trees. Then I catch movement. A ghostly figure, gray and white fur camouflaging with the winter forest. Brown eyes fix on me. A gray and white snout swings my way, black nose twitching as it inhales my scent. Ear pricked, swiveling when a noise comes from the side, the soft whoosh of snow falling from branches. It's a wolf, a lone young male. He has his head lowered, watching me, wary but curious. If it were a pack, Dalton would scoop me out of here fast. One wolf, though, is very unlikely to attack a person, not unless the beast is sick or starving. This one is muscular and well-fed. His fur ripples in the breeze, and he is one of the most beautiful things I've seen in a forest filled with beauty. I hear wolves all the time, and I've caught glimpses of them, but this is my first actual sighting, and I stay half-crouched and watching until his own curiosity wanes and he lopes off, a silent ghost vanishing into the snowy forest. When I return to Dalton, I'm grinning. He smiles, pleased. He's about to say something when Storm whines. "We should take her to sniff where he was," I say. "Let her learn the scent."
"Good idea."
He keeps his hand firmly around her collar and starts into the forest to where the wolf had been. Storm doesn't budge. Nervous because it's another canine? I wonder.
Maybe.
When he tugs her, she whines and her head whips around, gaze fixed behind us. She makes a sound that starts like a growl, but then she swallows it and whines instead. Something moves in the thicker trees behind us. I freeze. We'd presumed the wolf was alone, but that isn't necessarily so. Dalton's eyes narrow. I resist the urge to watch him and turn my attention to Storm instead. Her gaze stays fixed on a single point. That's reassuring, suggesting she only smells one threat. She's uncertain, too, about whether or not it is a threat. Her whine slips into a growl, and then back to a whine. Her ears prick forward and then relax. Her snout wrinkles, but she doesn't bare her teeth. I hunker to her height and look where she does. I see snow and trees. Then, movement above my crouched head. Moose? Caribou? That would explain Storm's reaction. Ungulates might not be predators, but they're still dangerous. Storm surprised a doe last fall and took a good kick in the ribs as it fled. Yet the shape has moved behind a tree, and if it were an ungulate, I'd see the hindquarters sticking out. It's at least as tall as me and can hide behind a thick tree trunk, which only describes one beast in this forest. Human. Chapter 14. I glance at Dalton. He's seen what I have. He grunts, considering, his hand on his gun. Then he motions for me to hold the dog while he circles around. I aim my gun at the tree, but it's a one-handed aim, my other on the dog's collar. I flex my left hand, ready to release the collar and steady my weapon if I need to. Dalton takes two wide steps, his snowshoes coming down soundlessly. Another flicker of movement. My hand nearly releases Storm's collar. Then the figure steps out and says, "Eric." I exhale. My gun lowers. Storm whines and dances, not excitement, but nerves. She knows who this is, and she still isn't sure what to make of her, isn't convinced she doesn't pose a threat. But I know better. Dalton does too, holstering his gun as he approaches her.
"Marianne," he says.
I release Storm and move forward as the dog stays close enough to brush my leg. Marianne is, or was, a hostile. I hesitate to say was because I'm honestly not sure of her status with them. I believe she left her group this spring. I cannot say for certain because our relationship hasn't progressed far enough for me to ask. Marianne is a former resident of Rockton. That much I can say for certain. Dalton had been a teenager when she arrived. As a biologist and professor, Marianne found peace and happiness in the wilderness, and when a group headed into the forest, she joined them. Jean Dalton had pursued the quartet, and the militia found their camp destroyed, splattered with blood, but no bodies. A year later, Dalton ran across Marianne in the forest. When she'd been in Rockton, they'd been friends, Marianne teaching him the science of the wilderness while he taught her the reality of it. So she very clearly knew Dalton, trusted him, liked him. And when he found her in the forest, she attacked him. He'd nearly had to kill her to escape. Earlier this year, we'd encountered Marianne again, still with the hostiles, but I'm not sure of the analogy to use here. She was like someone buried under an avalanche who had clawed her way up just enough to be heard. That avalanche was the collapse of her own mind into madness. She'd cleared just enough of a hole in the mental confusion to hear Dalton, yet she was still at the bottom, out of his reach. The encounter, though, had been a tipping point for her. She heard a voice she recognized, and she could make out the sunlight above and start climbing toward it. And here is where the analogy fails, because in such a case, you'd eventually be able to offer the victim a hand to haul them out. Marianne is not ready to take that hand, because what she's suffered isn't hypothermia and broken bones. Her damage goes deeper. Some of that damage is physical. Teeth filed, ritualized scarring, an ear and a couple of fingers blackened by frostbite. For a brilliant woman to start regaining her self-awareness and realize what she's done to herself, to know it isn't just a bad tattoo that can be covered up with long sleeves, and to know what those physical signs represent, proof of what she had become, the things she had done as a hostile. Marianne is indeed still buried, under an avalanche of shame and self-loathing now, and we cannot seem to pull her out. We've seen her a few times over the summer and fall. Her mind has cleared enough to communicate with us, when she chooses to. We've tried leaving supplies out for her, but that is too much like leaving food for a stray dog, and she shuns our offerings. What we want is to bring her back to Rockton. Part of that is, of course, selfish. She represents the key to understanding the hostiles. But even without that, we want to help her. Letting Marianne stay out here hurts no one but her. And yet, here she is, in the middle of December, with ragged boots and multiple shirts and no jacket, wearing a thin hood tied over her head. On her hands, she's tied more skins, wrapped around like extended sleeves, her fingers bare inside. This is where my beliefs waver, where they have always wavered. I struggled with that as a patrol officer seeing the homeless. Yes, if you choose to live on the streets, no one should be able to forcibly remove you. But at what point are you no longer making a sane choice? If I recognize signs of mental illness or drug addiction, how do I know whether you are still capable of making that choice? At what point would I be infringing on your rights if I shuttled you off to a shelter or a hospital? And at what point am I failing as a public servant, as a human being, if I do not? Marianne is aware of her choices and her options. She stays out of shame and fear. And so, is that enough for me to say it's her right? I see the same war on Dalton's face. As he approaches her, his cheek ticks in a way I know well. He's holding in his frustration. What she sees, though, is anger in those blazing gray eyes. She takes a step back. Eric? Hey, Marianne, I say, giving him time to cover his reaction. May I bring the dog over? She nods and smiles. It's a tight-lipped smile, as always, just as she barely opens her mouth when she speaks, hiding her filed teeth. I lead Storm to her, and she pushes her wrapped hands out to pet her, rubbing her back and sliding her fingers through the thick fur, warming them. I take off my backpack. I have extra mittens. Why don't you take?
No,
Dalton says, so low it's more growl than word. He pulls the backpack from my hands and snaps the zipper shut.
Casey is not giving you her gloves.
Marianne blinks.
I don't need...
Fuck yes you do. How do you think you got frostbite the last time? Apparently you kinda like it.
I have to bite back the urge to stop him. I know what he's doing, and I keep silent.
You don't want help from us, remember?
He says.
So you're not getting Casey's extra mitts or sweater or whatever else she wants to give you. Not unless you're willing to accept real help.
She takes a slow step back.
Yeah, that's great,
Dalton says, tossing my backpack down.
Turn tail and run like you do every time we say something you don't like. And next time we see you, it'll be your frozen corpse in the snow. Or maybe we won't find that until spring thaw. That'll be fun. Casey will blame me for not letting her give you stuff. She might even dump me for being such an insensitive ass. Imagine how we'll both feel knowing we couldn't help you. But we can't keep doing this, Marianne. A pair of mittens isn't going to get you through this winter. You need proper shelter, like a cave.
Her brows rise at that, and I see a flash of the woman she was.
A cave? It belonged to a friend of ours.
His voice catches before he pushes on.
He passed away this spring. I sealed it up, so all his stuff is still in there. It's nice for a cave.
It really is, I say. It has a couple of rooms, plenty of skins, a fire pit, preserved meat and food, weapons. He was living better than most settlers.
Yeah,
Dalton says.
It's fully stocked and it's secure. It's not exactly warm when the fire goes out, but it isn't freezing either. The temperature in a cave
is consistent year-round, she says, her voice scratchy, unaccustomed to more than a word or two at a time. It's approximately the same as the average temperature in the region.
Dalton allows himself a smile.
You remember. Good girl.
He gets a look for that. Definitely the Marianne she used to be.
I would like that, Eric.
She speaks in that same rusty voice, faltering and hesitant.
All right, then. Let me give you directions.
I lay my hand on his arm. I'd like to take her to Rockton to see whether she can identify.
Shit. Yeah. Okay.
We exchange a look that says, yes, I really do want to see if she can ID our victim, but I also want April to take a look at her, and this is a good way to go about it. A solid reason for Marianne to come to Rockton. I turn to Marianne. We found a dead woman with a baby. She inhales sharply.
A dead baby?
No, the baby's fine, but the woman shows signs of having once been what you were.
A hostile? You can say the word, Casey. I knew it, and it is not wrong. That's what we...
I...
She swallows.
It's accurate, and... Yes, I will look at this woman, though I'm not sure I'll be able to identify her.
Whatever you can give will help. Will you come, please? Marianne nods. Dalton reaches to take the dog from me.
You two go back to town. Storm and I can talk to Ty.
When I hesitate, he says,
I have Storm and two guns. I'll be fine.
Maybe we can walk part way with...
We'd be heading off the path soon. I'd rather you went back while we're still on it.
He's right. That's safer with a straightaway to Rockton. He gives me a one-armed hug and leans over as close as our snowshoes will allow. His lips press against my forehead and he murmurs,
I'll be fine.
He will be. Before I came, he spent most of his alone time in the forest. I nod and he gives me another quick hug and then heads off.
You're lucky,
Marianne murmurs as he leaves.
Yep, I am.
Dalton calls back, not turning. I smile. Then I dig in my backpack for the extra mittens and an extra scarf and hand them to her. And we head out. Chapter 15. I'm not much for initiating conversation. I'm fine with joining it or even sustaining it, but put me in a group and I keep quiet until I have something to say. One-on-one, I'll talk, but even then, I prefer an easy rhythm. with room for comfortable pauses, like I get with Dalton or Petra. I'm also fine with someone who picks up the slack and keeps me entertained, like Anders or Diana. People have called me reserved, even standoffish. They chalk it up to my Asian ancestry. Clearly, I'm playing to type. That's bullshit. My mother had no problem talking. It was my Scottish dad who'd been content to listen and let her fill the silence. I don't tell people that. If they want to cast me into an inscrutable Asian stereotype, then it keeps me from having to speak to them. It isn't long into the walk with Marianne before I'm really wishing I'd let Dalton walk back with her. He knows Marianne. All I can think of are the questions I want to ask, and as a scientist, she'll be the first to realize I'm treating her as a subject rather than a person. So I offer her things, like an overexuberant puppy dropping gifts at a stranger's feet. Would you like to wear the snowshoes? No? Are you warm enough? I've got a hood, so I don't really need my hat. I'm wearing an extra sweater. Would that help? Oh, I should have offered food and water. I have both. Okay, well, just let me know if you get hungry or thirsty or you need to stop for a rest. It's a wonder I don't drive her off, screaming into the forest. I do mention that I'd like our doctor to take a look at Marianne. She tenses, and I can tell she'd like to flee, but she's a smart woman and she knows a checkup is in her best interests. When she agrees, I seize on a topic of conversation and tell her all about my sister, her name, her specialty. And that gets her interest, as a fellow scientist, but it's still awkward, as if we're both fumbling for common ground. Had you ever been up here before, Rockton? She asks finally. To the Yukon, I mean. I shake my head, and I'm about to expand on that, but she takes over, this clearly being more than an idle question. I did, she says. My parents were late era hippies. I grew up on a tiny island in British Columbia where they taught at the one-room schoolhouse. We raised goats for milk and chickens for eggs. We grew all our own vegetables. Vacations for us meant camping someplace even more remote than our island. Her speech isn't fluid. It stops and starts, and she struggles for words, and sometimes her voice cracks from disuse. Like the Yukon, I prompt. She nods. We came up here a few times. For people who worshipped Mother Nature, this was our Mecca. There were jamborees in the 70s, and we piled into VW vans and drove. I remember this one event where they'd hired native Canadian locals. They showed us how to track animals, how to start fires with flints, and they led us through rituals that I'm sure were completely fake. She pauses for breath, and I let the silence go on, not wanting to rush her. After a moment, she continues. One day, I overheard two of them. Some people at the jamboree had been talking about going into the bush permanently. Just drive north till their car ran out of gas. Walk into the forest and live off the land. These locals laughed about that. Said they wouldn't survive a week. I was about eight at the time, and I told my mother, and she said the idea of running off into the forest was romantic escapism. Those campers wouldn't survive without access to modern amenities, not when the biggest complaint at the jamboree was how far people had to walk to the showers. The path branches, and I wave her down the left side. After a few more steps, she resumes her story. People in Rockton are like some of the ones at those jamborees. They're aghast at the portable toilets and the lousy showers, but compared to backcountry camping, Rockton is a 4-star wilderness resort. When I first heard rumors and whispers about Rockton, I thought it couldn't possibly be real. The chance that I could escape my situation by going to a place where I'd
gladly pay to vacation. I also needed that escape. My husband, she shakes her head. It's an old story. I won't bore you with it. I wouldn't be bored. A smile my way. Another time. This is a deep breath. I know you want to know what happened to me, and that's where I'm heading. Another smile. Eventually. My point was that those native guides said that Jamboree people wouldn't survive a week in the woods, and my mother thought that meant because of the lack of amenities. What they really meant was basic survival. The four of us who left Rockton didn't wander into the forest with pie-eyed visions of Mother Nature providing what we needed. I was a biologist with backwoods experience. One of the men was an engineer turned eco-house builder, specializing in northern living. Another was a doctor who'd hiked the entire Appalachian Trail alone. The woman was a third-generation wilderness guide. We had the skills. We knew where to camp, how to secure our food supply. But we had no idea. She takes a deep breath. The hostiles came in the night. We didn't stand a chance. We'd heard the rumors, of course, of wild people in the forest. And the others scoffed. Personally, I was fascinated by the tales. Modern folklore in action. The creation of a monster to shape behavior. Fairy tales to keep us out of the forest. And not believing. We weren't prepared. It happened so fast. I know that's what people always say, but you don't really understand the phrase until something like that. One minute you're sleeping, and the next it's chaos. Shouting, screaming, shadows against the night. That's all they were. Shadows. They put out our fire before they attacked. I woke to Dan, the doctor, screaming like I'd never heard a person scream. They'd sliced open his stomach and... Her breathing picks up. She scoops snow with a shaking hand, two mouthfuls. Then, in a calm monotone, they killed the men. Then they trussed up the other woman, Laura, and me, and dragged us off. After that, it's a blur. Mostly. She starts to shiver, and I take off my jacket, though I know it isn't cold making her shake. I still put my parka around her, and she takes it, gripping it close. "It's all I can manage for now," she whispers. "It's enough," I say. "Thank you." She nods. "Would you like a story about Rockton?" I say. "I may have a few." She manages a smile. "I'll take as many as you've got." Chapter 16. We're close to Rockton. I'm listening for signs of activity outside the town. "We'll loop around," I begin, and the bushes explode, a gray canine leaping through. It looks like a wolf, and my hand drops to my gun. Then Raoul jumps on me with a gleeful yelp, and Marianne attacks. It happens in a blink. I'm relaxing, recognizing our freckle-faced wolf dog as he plants his forepaws on my stomach. But Marianne sees only a wolf leaping onto me. In a blink, she has her knife out and she's attacking with an inhuman howl. I grab Raoul and roll, shielding him. The knife slashes through my doubled-up sweaters and slices my arm. I let out a hiss of pain as Raoul whimpers under me. "He's ours," I say quickly. "He's okay." Silence. Gripping Raoul by the collar, I turn over to see Marianne staring at my arm. Blood drips into the snow. She looks down at the bloody knife in her hand. Then she wheels, and I know she's going to bolt. I let go of Raoul and grab her by the pant leg. The seam rips as she lunges, but I hold tight.
Please, I say. I'm all right. It was a mistake. I'm...
Bushes crash. Raoul ducks and sidles up against me, still lying in the snow. He whines as Jen bursts through.
You damn mutt, she snarls. What the hell?
She sees Marianne, who is poised there, mouth open. Jen blinks.
Fuck.
Marianne's eyes go wide, realizing what she must look like. She lunges away again, and I'm dragged a few feet before I manage to stop, still holding her tight.
Jen, go, I say. Please.
Marianne, I'm sorry. It's okay. Everything's okay. She's pulling, and I have her pant leg in both hands now, pain ripping down my injured arm. Jen's saying something, but I can't make it out. Raoul thinks it's a game and growls, dancing around us. Marianne gives one big heave, and I'm certain that's it. She's gone, and goddammit, why the hell is Raoul? Marianne stops.
Eric,
she whispers. I follow her gaze to see a figure loping toward us. It's not Dalton, though. It's Sebastian. He skids to a stop, seeing us.
Shit, I'm sorry. I was walking him off leash and...
He sees Marianne, gets a good look at her. There's exactly 2 seconds of silence, and I swear I see his brain whir, lightning fast. Then he smiles and extends a hand.
Sebastian.
She blinks, and when she speaks, it's a near mumble as she tries to keep her teeth covered.
You looked a little like Eric, as a boy.
Sebastian's smile grows.
You knew Sheriff Dalton when he was younger? Cool.
His voice is calm, completely unperturbed by this wild-haired woman clad in makeshift clothing.
I'm sorry, Jen says. Didn't mean to startle you. This damned mud and this damned kid,
she glowers at Sebastian.
Thanks for helping me get him,
Sebastian says. Jen rewards his politeness with a raised middle finger. He ignores it and takes Raoul by the collar, scolding him in French. Sebastian looks at Marianne.
He's mostly wolf, but he's tame. He's pretty well trained until he wants to run, and then he somehow forgets his own name.
She smiles at that, forgetting her teeth until her hand flies up to cover them. But Sebastian pretends not to notice. He has a way with people. Of course, that has something to do with being a sociopath. He's not the stereotypically suave charmer that Hollywood loves, but there's a disarming charisma to him that's hard to ignore when he switches it on.
Sebastian, I say.
On your way through town, could you please find my sister and ask her to meet me at my old house? Tell her to bring a first aid kit.
What do you need me to do?
Jen asks. I hesitate. I want to tell her to just back off and stay out of our way after nearly sending Marianne fleeing into the forest. But she's been quiet since then and looks almost abashed.
Bring food and drink and clothing, I say. Whatever you spend, we'll reimburse. Just do it as discreetly as possible.
I pause, realizing who I'm speaking to.
Shit. This is very important. Don't tell anyone.
I stop suddenly.
Wait. If you're here, where's the baby?
In a snowbank over there. Don't worry, she's got plenty to eat. I tied some bacon around her neck. That's okay, right?
Jen, where's
with Will at the station? We were out for a stroll when this kid lost his wolf puppy. I gave the baby to Will and came to help round up the damned mutt.
Which was very kind of her, Sebastian says. It has nothing to do with the fact that the reason Raoul took off is because she yelled at him for running to see the baby. Fuck you, brat. Keep your damn wolf on a leash or the next time I see it.
She catches my eye and grumbles. Keep him on a leash. Jen stalks off. She's really very nice when you get to know her, Sebastian says, and then shakes his head and mouths to Marianne. No, she's not.
I heard that,
Jen calls back.
I didn't say a word. Believe me, I still heard it.
Sebastian gives Raoul a pat and says goodbye to Marianne, and they take off, zooming past Jen on their way.
He seems like a sweet boy, Marianne says.
I make a non-committal noise and lead her toward town. As eager as I am to get Marianne to the clinic to attempt identification of the dead woman,
I know I need to take this slower. Let April examine her first at my house. I want her checked out, and I want the rest of her story, whatever can help me understand hostels for this case and beyond. Once Marianne sees the dead woman, though, her obligation is fulfilled and she can flee into the forest. So that will need to wait until post-examination. It's not as if I can leave town chasing new clues anyway, not while Dalton is gone. The back door to my old house is locked. Increased tensions with both the hostels and settlers have made it seem unwise to leave buildings with open access to the woods. For my old place, though, there's a key under the back deck, since it is technically still my lodgings. And sometimes, if work's slow, Dalton and I have been known to go on patrol and sneak in the back for an afternoon nap. Marianne has said nothing since Jen and Sebastian left, and I've spent the walk stifling the urge to hold her arm to make sure she doesn't bolt. My own arm is fine. The blade sliced the skin, nothing more. A bandage will fix it up. I open my door and usher Marianne through. She steps in and stops. I'm behind her and she's blocking the entrance, but I pause, waiting. When she doesn't move, I slide past her and I realize she's crying. She's standing just inside the door, silent tears rolling down her face. I take off her parka. She doesn't even seem to notice. I bend and unfasten her boots, which really are little more than hides roped around her ankles. I untie the bindings and then head into the living room, saying, "I'll start the fire." I keep an ear on the kitchen. If the door squeaks, I'll be there in a flash. Instead, tentative footsteps slide across the kitchen. I hurry to get the fire going. It's laid, needing only a match to light. At this time of year, an afternoon nap is a whole lot less enticing if it means setting a fire first. I get it started in seconds. Then I feed in more kindling and put the kettle on. When I turn, Marianne stands in the middle of the room. She looks at the roaring fire, the kettle, the sofa piled with pillows, the bearskin rug, inviting in a way only a fireplace rug in winter truly can be. She stares, blinks. Then her knees give way. I lunge, but I'm too slow, and she falls onto the rug. Tears stream down her face, silent at first, and then ripping out in racking sobs as she crumples, arms wrapped around her chest. I should go to her, hug her, comfort her. Instead, I manage a few back pats and, "It's okay," and, "You're safe now," which are as awkward for her as they are for me. So I leave her to cry, and I dart around, getting things to make her comfortable. Put pillows on the floor, grab more from behind the sofa and blankets from under it, in a place this small you use every cranny for storage. I build a nest around her, as if she's a toddler who might fall. Then I go into the kitchen. There's not much there. Instant coffee and tea in the cupboard, powdered creamer and sugar, a bottle of tequila hidden under the cupboard. I bring it all. Then I check the kettle. It's barely simmering. I don't ask Marianne whether she wants tea, coffee, or tequila. She's crying softer now, collapsed on the rug, hugging a pillow. I drape a blanket over her. Then I pour tequila into one mug, put a tea bag in another, and coffee in the third. The kettle gives one chirp, and I have it off the hanger. I fill the two mugs. Then I set them on the tray in front of her. "Food's coming," I say. "But I have tea, coffee, and tequila." "Tequila?" She lifts her face from the rug. I hold the mug out. She shakes her head, shivering. "It'll be a long time before I'll even want painkillers." I push forward the other mugs. She accepts the coffee and rejects creamer or sugar. She sits up, blanket still over her shoulders as she wraps her hands around the mug. She leans over it, bathing in the steam. I put the kettle back over the fire in case she wants more. Then I look around. "I should have a sweatshirt upstairs," I say. "And socks, maybe? I'll run." A hard rap at the door. I open it to find Jen with a duffel bag, which she shoves at me. "Clothing," she says. "It's mine, but it should fit. There are snacks in there, too. I'll drop off a hot meal when I bring the baby." "Baby? I really can't. If you need me to take her a while longer, I will, but she's fussy and cranky,
and she wants her mommy. Yes, I say evenly. Unfortunately, we have no idea where to find her. She snorts. Whatever. She doesn't want me, Jen.
Well, yeah, she'd probably rather have Daddy. Typical female, already making eyes at the big bad sheriff.
But since he's not here, you'll do. When I start to protest, she says, I'm not trying to get rid of her, Casey. Just take her. Rock her a bit while April looks after the patient, and she'll fall asleep, and you can call me to take her back. She's unsettled, and she needs sleep, and she's not getting it until she sees temporary mom or dad. I pause and heft the duffel, turning toward the living room. And I'm sorry about spooking the patient, Jen says. She just surprised me, that's all. When I glance over, she says, yeah, I'm apologizing. To her, mostly. It's like when I kicked your damn dog. I didn't think. I just reacted. I'd never have done it otherwise. I nod. Go ahead and bring the baby. Chapter 17. I'm getting Marianne into clothing when my sister arrives. April walks in, sees what we're doing, and says, you can stop that, or we'll just be taking it all off again. April glances at Marianne and nods. It looks like a curt nod, but it's simple efficiency, as she strides past us to set down her bag. Marianne could be any patient in the clinic, just another job in April's day, no greeting required. We fielded complaints about my sister's lack of bedside manner. I direct the residents to Dalton, who reminds them that we spent the last fucking year without a fucking doctor. And now we have a fucking multi-degree neurosurgeon, and they're complaining because she doesn't ask how they're fucking doing. Which, considering she's a fucking doctor, she's going to find out anyway, isn't she? That's verbatim, although he may find an opportunity for another profanity that I've missed. I think we should work on this with April. Dalton says no. Not a fuck no, or even hell no, which means he isn't adamantly opposed to a little gentle guidance. But since it's not a lack of compassion, residents should adjust their expectations instead. As Dalton says,
they want a fucking hug? Talk to Isabel's girls.
He has a point.
He also said,
would they complain so much if April was a man?
Ouch.
He's right. I'm not sure I would have advocated for a softer touch if she were a man, and oof, that stings. Especially when, as a cop, I've been accused of not being warm enough. While no one ever said that to my male colleagues. It burns to realize I fell into the same trap, but it's a reminder I need sometimes. Just because I advocate for gender equality doesn't immunize me against promoting stereotypes. Even Dalton, who has never treated me differently than he would a male colleague, had an all-male militia until I arrived, and he'd never considered how that might discourage women from joining. With Marianne, though, I am glad of my sister's cool professionalism. As April conducts a preliminary examination, Marianne visibly relaxes. This is familiar. It's what she would have expected for a routine physical. Check heart, check eyes, check throat, check teeth. April checks the last as perfunctorily as the rest, without even a moment's pause at the filed teeth. But then, after the quick assessment, she says, dental work will be required, and Marianne cringes just a little. There's a cavity at the back, April says, possibly two. We have medication to help with those if they cause pain eating. The front teeth will require caps.
Caps?
Unless you plan to grow new ones, which I would not advise. Marianne snorts a laugh at this, and I relax. My sister has been attempting humor lately. That's one of the biggest hurdles with her condition. She struggles to understand jokes, and her silence marks her as humorless. She's working on that. The problem, of course, is that her absolute deadpan delivery, people usually aren't sure she is kidding.
I hadn't considered caps, Marianne says. That would work, I think.
It would. I have one on my left upper lateral incisor. Casey chipped off the corner. She threw a baseball for me to catch, and her aim was atrocious.
What?
I say.
When was this?
When you were three. You must remember, Casey.
Not if I was three, I don't.
That may explain why you never apologized.
I'm sure I did at the time. No, she pauses. You did cry, quite a bit. I suppose that's an apology. Her tone says she's granting me the benefit of the doubt here. A lot of benefit for a lot of doubt. Well, I am sorry, I say. Very sorry. I suppose an apology 29 years late is better than none at all. Marianne laughs, though this, I know, is not a joke. April's right, I say. Caps will fix your teeth. They will cover the damage, April says. They will not fix them.